Welcome to Independent Curriculum, the podcast. Independent Curriculum highlights the ideas, organizations, schools, and individuals playing important roles in shaping the future of education. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the Independent Curriculum Group, a global consortium of over 140 schools interested in building stronger, more effective academic programs that meet the needs of their own students in alignment with each school's unique mission and values. You can learn more about us by visiting our website at independentcurriculum.org. For this episode, we focus on both an organization, the National Association of Independent Schools, and an individual. I am fortunate to have as my guest today an old friend, Tim Fish, who recently began a new position at NAIS as their very first Chief Innovation Officer. Tim comes to this work after an already remarkable career as an educator and as a leader of innovation. And I want to say that this will be part one of a two-part podcast. We hope you will return for part two, available today, and for all our future independent curriculum podcasts. Tim, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Peter. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm going to jump right in. So, what is the Chief Innovation Officer at NAIS going to be doing? Is it about helping NAIS be more innovative, or about supporting member schools in their efforts to be more forward-looking in their programmatic and strategic thinking?
Peter, that's an excellent question, and it's one that we've been refining over the last 2 months that I've been in the role at NAIS. I think it's the simple answer to your question is it's both. I think there's, you know, we right now, one of the things that we're doing is we think that innovation is something that is very much on the minds of schools and is very much on the mind and the sort of top of mind at NAIS. And I think as we sort of speak about this, I'm so glad that you've asked me to join, because I think one of the things I'd love to dive into with you a little bit is a conversation about exactly what is innovation, right? Because I think it's frankly a word that's overused, a word that's used in many, many different contexts. And I don't think often we all mean the same thing when we mention it, right? And I have read many, many different ideas and thoughts about what exactly innovation is and how you get it. I'll sort of give you a sense now of what we're thinking about and where particularly our focus is around this topic. Right now, we're using very much, as I think about innovation, and this came a lot from my conversations with Donna Oram, and particularly two books that that the entire leadership team at NAIS read, that was called How Stella Saved the Farm. And the other book that Donna actually had passed on to me early last year, which is called The Other Side of Innovation, Solving the Execution Challenge. And it's written very much from the point of view of what they refer to in the book is sort of what I call going down the mountain with innovation, which means often when folks think about innovation, there's an idea that it's about, you know, putting a bunch of people in a room and putting chart paper on the wall and having people just throw out ideas, and, you know, any idea is a good idea, and all those things in many cases are true, and they are a part of the innovation process. What I like so much about the authors in these two books that I mentioned is they really speak about sort of the other side of innovation, which is once you have really spent some time identifying the problem or the opportunity that you're trying to solve, right? What's the challenge? What is in front of you? Why are you trying to innovate? And then you go through a process of defining that and go through a process of determining what the idea is. That to them is sort of what they would refer to paraphrase, as sort of the summit experience, right? So I'll use my own example here a little bit, right? So I started, thanks to the generosity of McDonough and a very forward-thinking board, I was at McDonough School for for several years, for 18 years, in fact, before taking this position at NAIS. And I had the opportunity to take a year off to start something called the Folio Collaborative. And the Folio Collaborative is now a nonprofit, separate nonprofit organization of about 135 schools around the world that are really coming together to talk about faculty development. And Peter, you've been a part of that conversation since the very beginning, and we are so thankful for what you brought to the table and continue to bring to the table with Folio. And the thing about Folio was, sort of, we came up with this idea about a process and about software to manage the process. And I think very much when that happened and we sort of got to that place where we knew what it was that we wanted to build and what we wanted to do, that was what they would refer to as the summit, right? We were sort of at the top. We had worked hard. We slogged our way up. We were standing at the summit. We were eating our granola bar. And we were all looking out at this sort of beautiful view and so proud of ourselves for what we had accomplished. But then we had to go down the mountain, right? And when you go down the mountain, in fact, you're exhausted because you've been hiking all day and you don't have any more granola bars and you've been sucking oxygen for a while and it's getting dark. And essentially, sort of going down the mountain is where people get killed, right? Because going down the mountain, no one does any planning for going down the mountain, right? It's all about, all your planning is about going up the mountain. And the work that I'm particularly interested right now in, as I think about innovation, is the execution side of innovation, right? What are the specific processes and disciplines and questions and frameworks that schools can use so that over time we build internally what I would call the capacity to reimagine our own futures, right? To constantly be reimagining our future. You know, there's a great author named John Keogh who wrote a book on innovation, and the name is actually escaping me. It's right behind me. I may grab it if I get 2 seconds. But in the book, he defines innovation this way, that as innovation is a portfolio of capabilities at the individual, institutional, or societal levels that enable you to continuously realize a desired future, right? And I think that's a phenomenal definition of innovation, right? It's the notion of, it's a portfolio, it's not one thing, right? What I've referred to internally as an engine of innovation, right? It's not so much what you do, it's that you have the capability to do anything, right? That you have the capability to go from a challenge or an opportunity through a brainstorming, idea generation, solution execution, evaluation, reimagination, kind of do it again, right? Do you have the ability to do that process? It's capabilities, right? It's something that can be learned. It's something that individual institution has. And it enables you to continuously, which I love, realize a desired future, right? Not that there's any one specific way. It's what I love about our schools is there are in their, I think our beauty in so many ways is in our independence. And I think here's an example of that. It's that realizing that desired future. So for me, just to kind of make a very, very long-winded answer, I think the position was created because I think NAIS sees the need for this capacity in our schools to continue to help our schools figure out how to be really good at innovation in the way that I've described it, not just the sort of bright, shiny object that we're chasing, right? But really serious innovation. And that NAIS also is poised in a position of thinking in an innovative way to address schools' immediate challenges, needs. So my work and the team that I'm working with is really looking at both sides of that coin.
That's going to be quite an evolution for the organization and a great resource for schools, I think. I'm going to come back to a couple of the points you made in a second, but first, I didn't really give you an opportunity to talk about yourself, and we'd love to know sort of how you wound up at NAIS and what your journey as an educator has been and an innovator to the place that you now have at NAIS.
That's a great question. So my career started, I think my journey as an educator started when I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. And my father was a computer science professor at Bucks County Community College in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And he started that job when the PDP-8, which was a digital prime computer, was.
Sure.
Yeah, I know you know the PDP-8, I'm sure, and then the PDP-11, right? And it's big brother and or sister. And so as a child, my basement was full of computer stuff, right? And but more importantly, as a child, my basement was full of my father's students. Community colleges, and the way my dad was a teacher, he was very big in believing in sort of this relationship-based, experience-based learning, right? And he was an engineer, but he would be the first to tell you that he never, I mean, in the computer science world, he was always just barely one step ahead of the students. And many, many times he was not even one step ahead of them. And he believed that he just wanted to open up the doors to learning for them. And so there were many, many Saturdays and Sundays when there was, a keg of beer and hot dogs on the grill and frisbees being thrown and soldering guns in the basement, all, students with my dad sitting around like in this kind of garage mode of computers, right? And I'm speaking specifically about like 1978, 1980, 19, that kind of era, right?
Sure.
And it was, I saw a perspective through my dad into sort of what teaching could be, right? And I don't know that it didn't stick with me, obviously, at the time, right? It just, I think it created a seed about joy in learning, about what that looks like. And so then I went to college. My father told me when I was going to college, he said, I don't care what you major in as long as it's hard. That was my dad's only advice, right? Which was like, I don't care if you can pick economics, chemistry, or physics, any one of the three, just pick one that's hard. And I chose chemistry, and then quickly found that that I didn't love chemistry, but I loved the idea of teaching. Switched my major, became an elementary education major, started teaching fourth grade. And it was the second summer in fourth grade teaching that I took a Mac LC home. And I fell in love. I fell in love with a program called HyperCard back in the day on the old Macs.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I started coding in HyperCard as a 23-year-old fourth grade teacher in Fairfax County, Virginia, and started building stuff for my kids and became inspired. And that led me to inner meeting. I got into a master's program with George Mason, and my mentor at the time was a guy named Chris Deedy, who's now at Harvard. And Chris is very much of a futurist, and he
Sure.
happened to have been at Mason at the time. And I got the great honor of working closely with him on some projects, and that lit me up. And then I jumped out of that, went into a role in Fairfax County after 4 years of teaching, where I was a technology coordinator, if you will, for 9 schools in Fairfax. And that was 1994 to 96. That was during NET days and during, sticking network cards and computers and arguing whether or not elementary schools would ever need to be connected to the internet and, stuff that was, it was on the cusp. And Fairfax was a school system that was very thoughtful at that time. And I left that job and took a job where I was managing tech initiatives at the district level. So I was kind of working with the 210 schools in Fairfax. And I came home one day and I said to my wife, like, it's been 3 weeks since I've seen a child, right? Like, I need to get out of this game. And so I found this job at McDonough, right? Which was a technology director job, which was, I'd gone from a big school system to McDonough at 1,200 students was a greenhouse. It was a small little test bed where we could do things. And I did tech, I was a tech director there for several years. And then I took a role where I was the head of the academic program. And then that morphed into strategic thinking and leading a big campus master plan, $70 million project. And I did a lot of fundraising around that. Then I took a year off and went out and started Folio and came back, ran admissions for 3 years, and still kind of had a lot to do with Folio's growth. And then I did another year as associate head, overseeing a bunch of stuff. And then last year, I had the opportunity to step into an interim role as the CFO at the school, which was another just huge, huge learning opportunity for me. And along the way, I just had conversations with Donna Oram, who I've known since my first days at McDonough in '98. I respect her immensely. And as you know, NAIS was going through some real transition last year with the unfortunate passing of John Chubb. And so Donna and I were just having conversations, and this sort of opportunity emerged naturally. And it was one that I was just incredibly interested to join team at NAIS. And that's kind of how I ended up at NAIS.
Wow, that's a story I did not know. That's fabulous. And I love the vision of you as a small boy watching your dad and his students plink around with the high tech from back in the day. Can talk a little bit about who then, besides your dad, I guess, have really been the big influences on you as an educator, and what are the experiences and maybe the ideas that have really captured you and helped you move forward, or driven you to move forward, perhaps.
Oh, well, there's been a bunch of them, right? So certainly my dad and Chris Deedy, I mentioned. Mr. Inglesby, my sixth grade science teacher. He did this project called The Contract, and it was a 3 month project, and he gave you this long document that had all these different projects you could do, right? You could build a solar oven to cook hot dogs. You could go out and take apart owl pellets. You could build a food web, right? All these different things, and each one had like a one paragraph description, and you got to decide like what you wanted to get on that project, right? If you wanted to do, X number of projects and get X number of points and have him sign off on them, then you'd get an A. And if you wanted to not do that and get a C, then you get a C, and you kind of got to decide, right? And for me, it was this phenomenal look into like just objective assessment, right? Like this is the deal. And he had this magical way of turning me on and turning other students on to science. And so I worked my butt off. Like every night when I came home, I was working on my contract because I wanted to, right? Not because there was homework. And I was always taking new things in, and he was signing off on them. And the other thing it made me do is hold on to a piece of paper for 3 months, right? Which is like impossible for a sixth grader to do. And so I guarded that document that had each of his signatures with each of my projects for like with my life. And so he really turned me on to learning. And it's funny because as I was at Fairfax, I read a great book, early book by Grant Wiggins, and that totally, performance-based assessment. Like he just, I mean, he really changed my whole way of thinking about teaching. And in sort of the early days, Jay McTighe was in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Grant Wiggins was doing a lot with Fairfax. And I got, because I was in the Department of Instruction, I really got to be in on that. That was back in 97, 96, 97. And that was had a huge impact on my thinking about learning. And I think one of the other ones, as I'm saying that also came to mind for me was the first time I read The Courage to Teach by Parker Palmer. That spoke to me. I read that at a time when I was really in the height of my tech period, and was really learning everything I could learn about servers and the internet and firewalls. And sort of Parker Palmer sort of enlightened me to the soulful side of teaching, the human side, the journey of the individual. And that just blew my hair back because I think, frankly, I think I've forgotten it. I think I've forgotten what it means to be a person, an individual on the journey, right? And I had gotten pretty programmatic about things. And that had a lot to do with Folio and sort of the evolution of that, which we could talk about at some point about how Folio changed from sort of, to be very kitschy, sort of a product to be bought it went from a product to be bought to a movement to be joined, right? This kind of idea that it's in the community and it comes from all of us. And that was highly influenced by the writings of Parker Palmer. So those are a few. I mean, there are so many, but those are a few that really, really spoke to me.
One of the things you spoke of with regard to the nature of innovation, and when you were describing one of the books, you mentioned the phrase desired outcomes. And I am really interested in that. I think one of the things that's been a challenge in independent schools has been the kind of drumbeat, maybe started by Pat Bassett at NAIS and maybe started by a lot of other people and certainly picked up by a lot of other people, that schools need to change. One of the things that I think many people found frustrating about that drumbeat was that there wasn't a kind of template or a formula or a particular end point in view or that was spelled out for schools. And so this idea of desired outcomes is in some ways the area where schools have been most left to their own devices. Now, as the executive director of the Independent Curriculum Group, we're all about the idea of each school finding its own and defining its own desired outcomes. But at the same time, do you think there are particular areas in which schools, as they approach this idea of innovation and even feel themselves under an imperative to innovate, are there particular kinds of endpoints, or are there particular places where schools can be looking or should be looking for endpoints so that these desired outcomes perhaps become a little more clear or at least a little bit more defined in what the pieces are, even if for each school the pieces are arranged differently?
You know, I think that's a great question. So what I've been learning over like the last year, I've really been spending a good amount of time thinking a little bit about innovation. And I spoke earlier about the whole notion of the execution side of it, right? And I think there is, I do think there's a process that if you go through, and it's not highly prescriptive, but I think there are real guiding principles that you need to sort of appreciate. And if you appreciate those and stay to a discipline in some ways, you can make innovation much more successful, right? And so to give you an example of that, right? So the last couple of years, I had the privilege of co-teaching a class in entrepreneurship for students at McDonough. And just as I spoke earlier about sort of Grant Wiggins and blowing my hair back in terms of my thinking about my teaching, co-teaching this class with a McDonough parent who was a successful entrepreneur, I think in many ways, same kind of impact on me, because we've taught this class during one trimester. It was a 2-hour class taught from 6 p.m. There's no prerequisite. Anybody in 9th through 12th grade who wanted to take it could take it. We were really open. We taught it in a pretty big room, so we didn't care how many people came to the class. At one point, we had 40 kids in the class.
Wow.
The guy who I taught it with had never taught. He went to business school and had run a very successful company, but was not a teacher by trade. Our first year doing it was horrible. We just weren't very successful. And we came back for a second year. But having done it for 3 or 4 years, I learned what we essentially did is it's kind of kitschy, but we did Shark Tank, right? And kids would come together, they would define a problem, they would build teams around a problem, they would iterate around a solution, they would build a company, and they would pitch the company to investors. And we bring in real investors who they would pitch this thing to. And what it showed me again was when you just kind of, each of those companies was vastly different, right? kind of a form of innovation, if you will, right? And by innovation, in that particular context, I mean it's something new that hasn't been done before, right? And the outcome is uncertain, right? So that's sort of the, those are the two things that we were often looking at. And the process, you know, one of the things that was very interesting, for example, coming out of that was how important the definition of the problem was and how important validating the problem was, right? So kids and I often would go to like, I want to invent a company where this happens, right? The sexy part is the, we're going to make an app that does this, right? The hard discipline was defining, does anybody want an app that does that? Is that a problem that people have, right? Is this a need to have or a nice to have? And I think often in schools, when we come up with ideas of things we want to do, and I am the most guilty of this. I do it because I think it's cool, right? But I don't really know what challenge in the school are we trying to solve? What learning is, are we trying, is at the center of this? What do we hope kids are going to gain from doing this? Albert Einstein, there was once a quote, I'm going to paraphrase, that said, if you gave me an hour to solve a problem, I'd spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem and 5 minutes thinking about the solution, right? Mm-hmm. It's that idea. And I think that we flip that on its head, right? I think we spend 5 minutes thinking about the problem and we spend 55 minutes, you know, planning out the solution and the budget for the solution and the timeline for the solution and who's going to be involved. And so just for example, getting good at thinking about the opportunity or the challenge that you're trying to address, getting really good at that capacity to do that really well is something that I think schools could really benefit from, right? And I think some, many schools and many individuals in schools are, in fact, good at that now, far better than I am or ever or was. But I think getting really good at that could very much help our schools as we think about everything from admissions and enrollment to curriculum and program and assessment and time, right? And so I do think that while the outcome of that process is should be driven by mission and should be autonomous in each school, and that I don't think it's NAIS's role to say this is the kind of school you should be, right? Mm-hmm. I think that we can help schools in thinking about and learning about that process, because the Folio thing taught me, for example, like what was so great about that is that my school gave me a year to basically read everything there was to read or I'd get my hands on around faculty growth and talk to people and dream and envision and build, right? And what emerged from that was the nugget of this Folio thing, which has evolved significantly since that initial nugget. But I think too often in our schools, we just go into a silo of our just our school and we try to reinvent this, you know, from nothing, right? And what Folio did is it gave everyone kind of a starting point, right? Not the prescription of exactly how to do it, but look, here's a lot of good thinking. You don't have to redo all this thinking. And I think that one of the other things that we can hopefully do, NAIS, ICG, other associations, is give schools some of the good thinking already so they don't have to start from nothing as they think about some of the opportunities and challenges that are coming.
I'm going to guess that that's probably a pretty large part of your personal mission with regard to this new position is getting schools to learn to ask one another questions, to listen to the answers, and to make those connections around big questions rather than solving their own problems in their own way, quietly, in a way that might be maybe good enough, but there might be better ideas out there. I love this idea of schools as problem refineries rather than solution factories.
Yeah, and I think even if you look at, you know, I think even if we that's a capacity, that problem identification thing, right, is what are we really trying to do with our ninth grade English program? You know, at the end of the day, right, this is just like any kind of, you know, understanding by design or teaching for understanding or any of these sort of frameworks. But sort of like, what are we trying to do? What's at the heart of this work, right? What problem are we trying to solve? I think when we go through that, you know, there's some research I've been doing recently, and I've gotten kind of all keyed up on this podcast. I'm just such a geek. I've been like listening to this podcast while I go running, right? But it's this group called Jobs to be Done. I don't know if you've heard about the Jobs to be Done framework. But it would be one thing that for the listeners to kind of go out there and Google JTBD, Jobs to be Done. I think it's jobstobedone.org, and there's a company called the Rewired Group. And essentially, one of the things that this sort of, the great example of this is when Clayton Christensen did a TED Talk about what people hire a milkshake to do, right? I don't know if you've ever seen that TED Talk. It gets this whole idea of what job are we hiring something to do, right? So when you buy an iPhone, right, or I'll just use sort of that as an example, right? What job are you hiring the iPhone to do for you, right? And what this whole methodology, it's kind of a marketing-based methodology, but what it's really good at is sort of diving in very deeply with a very specific kind of interview, where you get at this idea of what exactly do you want this curriculum or this phone or this duct tape to do for you, right? And as they have found, what they found about this is that as they go through an interview process with people and they think about either a product or a service or whatever, that they can get into really understanding what's at the heart of it. And, you know, what Clayton Christensen describes in this podcast is that they were doing research with Wendy's or somebody about milkshakes. And what they found is that, like, what job do people hire a milkshake to do? Well, actually, a lot of people are buying milkshakes on their way into work in the morning, right? And they were hiring it to be the drink that stays cold for a 45-minute commute, right? And it gives them something to do for 45 minutes in the car, which I thought was really interesting. So, another long-winded answer, but I think it's something that really has some bearing maybe for schools.
You've mentioned a couple of times your experience with the Folio Collaborative, and I'm wondering if you would sort of do a brief history of Folio and how Folio became a collaborative and what lessons there are for other school-driven or school-involved organizations, for example, the Independent Curriculum Group. What are the lessons in things that help schools break through those barriers to collaboration and to really begin to learn from one another and become a community?
It's a great question. You know, essentially, Folio, this process of faculty growth and development, was invented at McDonough, and we built software to manage it. Another school heard about it and said, we'd love to have this. And then we got this idea, hey, we could build this thing in a way other schools could use it, and we could generate revenue that could help McDonough. We could essentially be the next curriculum mapper, right? The next Rubicon Atlas, right? And so we kind of headed off to do this, A, to put something good in the world, clearly, to help our schools. But also, like, hey, we invented the answer to faculty evaluation and professional growth at McDonough, and here you need to buy our answer, right? And very quickly, two things became apparent for me. One is I am a data geek, right? If you get to spend a lot of time with me, you'll quickly discover that I love data. And I love thinking about data. And so I was really intrigued by something we built at McDonough in Folio, which was student feedback, students giving teachers anonymous feedback and build all these cool graphs that let you look at that feedback and blah, blah. And so I ran off, right? I didn't spend any time asking schools what they thought Folio should be. I was so confident that we had found the answer, right, that I ran off and said we could sell this thing. And McDonough, I thought, was very forward-thinking about taking a little bit of money out of the endowment and essentially becoming its own venture capital firm and sending its associate headmaster out into the wilderness for a year to build this thing. And I thought that there's a whole lot of lessons in that from a school perspective, this whole notion of a new revenue stream and what this could mean. And we could do a whole hour on that topic. But what happened was we built it and I ran around and I tried to sell it. Right. And I was literally like kind of in a sales mode for about 4 months. And I was learning a lot about faculty growth and development, but I was also like, I was trying to get people to buy this idea. And what I quickly discovered was really McDonough. It was McDonough had just, you know, opened the first beginning of the first chapter conversation about what does this really look like? And that the only way we as a community of independent schools was going to really answer the larger question about what are the best ideas around faculty development was if we did it together, right? And so what in the beginning of my work, if I had a 1 hour sort of pitch or meeting with a group of faculty, 45 minutes of that would have been on, let me show you how the software works, right? And 15 minutes was on like, this is some of the theory around this. And completely, I flipped that on its head. I had another one of those big moments on the train ride in New York to meet with Hewitt School in the Upper East Side, who was one of the only schools who had sort of gotten in on the concept, right, early on. And I was going up to meet with them again, and they're a phenomenal school. And
ICG school, I just want to say.
Oh, are they?
Yes,
great
indeed.
School. And great folks there. And I was heading up to see them, and it hit me that this whole notion of the core folio is not data, is not this research on student feedback, it's not the software. It's all about the fundamentals of a conversation, right? It's all about putting people in a room and giving them the opportunity to really talk. And for me, if I'm working with a teacher, to be motivated and working in service of that person, right? So a woman named Abigail Wevenson, who is phenomenal, was head of school at Lowell School for a long time in D.C. Abigail, I had the pleasure of spending some time with her that year, and she really opened my eyes to this other perspective on this. And started looking at more coaching research and started thinking about this. And the lesson to be learned about this, I think, is that I don't think we as independent schools need to be inventing everything by ourselves, right? I think we don't have the capacity to create a completely new way of thinking about curriculum from whole cloth and a completely new way of thinking about faculty growth and a completely new way of thinking about efficiency in power utilization and, you know, all this stuff. I just don't think we can. But I also don't think that, you know, one school's answer is every school's answer. And I believe fundamentally that it's we have to work in collaboration to develop a framework where we can share best practice for us with the invitation to other schools to say, what can you learn from this? And that is the beauty of it. And once Folio changed its perspective and became more about an invitation to do the journey together, it just became very successful, right? And it's really held true to that. And I think that the schools that are using it, I think, are finding that to be true.
That's a great lesson. And I think Folio is really one of the great models for the independent curriculum group in how we might proceed without a powerful software platform that at least begins to address a particular area of need, but with that similar notion of trying to get schools to share their answers and be open to asking questions in a community rather than just kind of one at a time. This ends part one of Independent Curriculum's interview with Tim Fish, Chief Innovation Officer at the National Association of Independent Schools. In part two, available here on iTunes, Tim and I will pursue more questions about the role of independent schools and what kinds of innovations are afoot. This is Peter Gao, thanking you for listening today and looking forward to having you with us in the future.